Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulip. Today I'm pleased to welcome back composer Jake Heggie and violinist-conductor Dawn Harms to talk about their involvement with The Violins of Hope, a priceless collection of recovered and meticulously restored instruments from the Holocaust era, which starts an 8-week residency in the Bay Area through March 15th with over 42 Bay Area organizations involved. The residency includes 50 of the 86 recovered Holocaust-era string instruments in the collection. Concerts, lectures, films, and exhibits are part of the mix. And this Saturday, you'll hear the world premiere of Intonations, songs from The Violins of Hope, written by Jake and sung by the great Sasha Cook. More about that shortly. I'll also talk with multilingual playwright and actor Anna Bayat about her one-woman show, Mimi's Suitcase, an autobiographical story about identity, immigration, women's rights, and involuntary displacement. It's based on her family's experience of returning to Iran in the 1980s from Spain, where she grew up. Writer-performer Kate Robards stops by to talk about her latest solo play, Polly Shamory, in which she plays Kate, who has everything she's ever dreamed of, but so does Kate's husband's girlfriend. It's a polyamory therapist and sex-positive ethos that you'll hear about, and an autobiographical tale of a polyamorous marriage that goes wrong. Listener discretion advised. Stay with us. If you're like me, this music may raise a goosebump or two. While not a part of the Violins of Hope concerts or presentations, just listening to John Williams' music from Schindler's List can evoke all kinds of emotional responses. But especially right now, as the music you just heard was performed live in our KALW studios by Dawn Harms on a violin that survived the Holocaust. Thanks to the efforts of 42 Bay Area organizations, the Violins of Hope, these iconic instruments, will be featured during a number of public events, including symphonic, chamber, and klezmer concerts, exhibitions, film screenings, community forums and lectures, interfaith dialogues, student-teacher workshops, and ecumenical services. Participating are, among many others, the San Francisco Symphony's chamber musicians, the New Century Chamber Orchestra, Oakland Symphony, the Peninsula Symphony Orchestra, Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, the Ariel Quartet, the Alexander String Quartet, and the Young Chamber Musicians of Burlingame. Two esteemed participants join me now in studio, the aforementioned Dawn Harms and composer Jake Heggie. Producing organization Music at Cole Mansion has commissioned award-winning composer, librettist team Jake Heggie and Gene Shear for a chamber work appropriate to the occasion, Intonations, Songs from the Violins of Hope. Performing its world premiere on January 19th, with a preview on the 18th, is renowned mezzo-soprano Sasha Cook, violinist Daniel Hope, and a string quartet that consists of members of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra, Dawn Harms among them. Each musician will be performing on one of the historic string instruments from the Violins of Hope collection. The Bay Area debut of this amazing violin collection coincides with the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp by the Soviet Army and with International Holocaust Remembrance Day on Monday, January 27th. Jake, Dawn, thank you so much for coming in today to talk about this amazing collection.
Thanks for having us. Wonderful to be back.
Yes, thank you.
Well, so much to talk about, but first, let's talk about the instrument that Don is playing. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the person who owned it. This is from Violins of Hope, Violins of the Holocaust, Instruments of Hope and Liberation in Mankind's Darkest Hour. Butcher and amateur violinist Erich Weininger was 25 years old and living in Vienna on March 11, 1938, when Austrian Chancellor Kurt Schuschnigg delivered an earth-shattering address over the radio. In a trembling voice, he announced that he would be resigning and handing over power to the Nazis. Schuschnigg's efforts to suppress the rise of Austrian Nazism had failed, as had his attempts to establish peace with Hitler. The German army marched into Austria later that night. Over the next 3 months, 70,000 Austrian Jews were arrested, principally in Vienna. Most were harassed and tortured for a few hours or days before being released. In May and June of that year, an additional 2,000 Jewish intellectuals who had been specifically targeted by the Nazis were arrested, beaten, and placed on three trains to Dachau. This included Erich Weininger, who arrived at the concentration camp on June 3, 1938. Jake, could you take up the story from there for me?
Sure. And thank you for setting that up, too. Erich was a violinist, as you mentioned, and Butcher, and he brought his violin with him, somehow managed to take it from Vienna to Dachau. He was then transferred to Buchenwald, and then during the great effort to rid Germany, Austria, etc., of all the Jews, he was put on a ship that was supposed to go to Palestine. Things went horribly wrong all along the way, but he managed to hold on to this violin. And years later, after being deterred to Mauritius and all these other places, and managing to hang on to this violin, he landed in Israel and lived his life there, visiting only occasionally to Europe. And when he died in 1988 at age 76, he gave his violin belonged to his children. They took it to a local violin maker named Amnon Weinstein in Tel Aviv, and told them the story about this. And he had already begun the collection Violins of Hope, instruments that were played by Jews and others during the Holocaust in concentration camps and elsewhere. And the Weinsteins had set about restoring these instruments over the past 20, 30 years and built this collection. And so the children of Erich Weininger gave the violin to Amnon Weinstein to restore. And it now has traveled to the hands of Don Harms to be part of this amazing weekend and residency.
And I didn't even know anything about this instrument. We were given about 20. They brought them to us at Herbst Theater. There were several people, the quartet and myself and some people in the symphony. We were just trying them randomly in this big room. They had a number, and I just tried, probably half a dozen or a dozen. And I just picked this one up, and it spoke to me. It just like... Again, I didn't know the history, and it just, the deepness of the G string, and it said something to me, and I just said, this is the one. And then Jake told me the story about it. It was just like jaw-dropping.
And amazingly, it's the subject of one of the songs in the new piece. There are six songs in this seven-movement piece. Each one is about one of the violins of hope. Gene Shear did a lot of research, not only in Jay Grimes' book, but also separately, and wrote stories that inspired him, and Erich Weininger's violin was one of them. And so Don happened to pick one of the violins that we are actually telling the story of in this piece, which I think is really remarkable.
The movement is the second in your work called Exile. And you use a unique way, or Gene is using a unique way of creating this libretto. He's putting the words he's taking, it's almost as if the violins are speaking to us.
We, when we were trying to figure out how to, first of all, we were enormously challenged by this. Patricia Christoph Moy at Cole Mansion, music at Cole Mansion, is the brains behind this whole thing. She wanted to bring the violins to the West Coast for the first time. She organized a commission. She organized all these partner organizations. She asked these wonderful players from the San Francisco Opera Orchestra, you know, Kay Stern, Don Harms, Emil Meland, Patricia Heller, to join us on this journey. And so when we started thinking about how we were going to write this piece, how are we going to tell these stories, we knew we would be using the actual violins, but we wanted a singer. I mean, that's what I do. I write for singers and I write theater. So how are we going to shape this? And we decided the singer would be the voice of the violin, able to tell the story of what happened to that instrument, while Daniel Hope, our solo violinist, is the violinist in that moment. So we're reliving those episodes in the history of this instrument. The amazing thing about these instruments, of course, is that they had a life before this very dark chapter in their existence. And they're of varying quality. Some of them are klezmer instruments. Some of them are very fine concert instruments. It's a real range. But, you know, the opportunity to tell those stories, which is so important because we all know cultural memory is very, very short, telling stories. I was talking to your guest, Anna, about that earlier, how we have to tell these stories. And doing it with music really just heightens the emotion and the experience for the audience. So it was a great challenge, but enormously gratifying.
Right. Dawn, you mentioned you tried several instruments. Are all of the instruments in the collection in playable condition, or is maybe the emotional and historical value sometimes even more important than the musical value?
Absolutely. These were all in complete playing condition because they were restored, but who knows what they looked like before. You know, they were just, the thought that they were stolen from these poor people who played them just like we do today. It'd be like if they came in today and took my Italian instrument and said, nope, we're taking it.
Yeah.
And they did this with paintings and everything they own. But then when you think about it and you're playing this, and I have to really step back and say, wow, this was somebody owned this and it was taken from them. You know, they had no choice. So I remember when I went to Terezin before I knew any of this, I was in the camp. I went where the women were kept, and it was, I just could hear them weeping. And so I think back then what it was like. I just felt them. I started weeping in the middle, and I couldn't control myself. So I try to it all comes back when I'm playing the instrument. And I just, and we're trying to also send the message of joy too, because they played it, like he said, Jake said before, they played it at regular concerts and they loved their instrument, and we're just here to tell that story.
Right. They're called Violins of Hope, which I think is very important to remember,
right,
because they can still sing. They're like the ultimate survivors that have been cared for and passed down, because culturally they're so important to share stories, and there's so much invested in them, so much life, love, blood, sweat, tears. The first violin that Amnon Weinstein restored, he took the cover of the violin off to look what was inside, and it was filled with human ashes. That's the very first song in the cycle is about that particular violin. So these violins have very important stories to tell us, very important trajectories and histories, and the Weinsteins have been collecting those stories as they collect and restore the instruments themselves.
But I must say, it's amazing how Jake and
Gino.
They take the text and the music and the harmonies, they hit it right on. You know exactly what's happening, and it just cuts you to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Like he said, the opening note is what we call a Bartok Pitz, and it pops. It's when he opens the violin and he sees the ashes. It's just, and from then on, everything, the way they use the harmonic progression with the text, it's quite a piece. I think it's going to have legs, and I think it should be performed all over the world.
It was challenging too, because they're not like regular songs where everyone knows the story and you can go right into the emotional moment. It's storytelling. Each one of them is a separate story, so you have to find a way very briefly to set the stage, what the violin is going through, what stage is it in, whose hands is it in now, what are they going through, and then get into the emotional journey of that. So, it was a very challenging project also to have all those strings and a voice and a solo violin. And we also have a young violinist, Sean Morey, who joins us for the last song, Liberation, which is in the spirit of L'Ador Vador, passing things to the next generation. And he walks up on stage with one of the violins and joins in the last song. It's very, very
miraculous. It's breathtaking.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your process, Jake, in terms of setting the words to music. Are you concerned not only with the emotional content of the words that are being set, but also the actual rhythmic values of the words that are going on?
Absolutely, 100%. The words have to be clear, and the singer has to be able to get them across so that you can go into the emotional world of those words. That's very important for me, text setting, so that it's really, really clear. And in this case, especially because there's so much to get into the spirit of the song, into the story of that instrument and the person that we're describing, whose journey we're describing. But I also want to be true to the sort of musical spirit of the time that it was played and the person who is playing it and the journey that they're on. So there are references, for example, in the fourth song, Motola, he was a young prodigy who his whole family was killed after he was 9 years old. And at 12, he found a way to sneak gunpowder into the German officers' club where he was being forced to perform against what he wanted, of course, but to survive. And he built a bomb with all this gunpowder and blew up the officers' club. And I decided that the piece that he had been performing that made him famous at 9 years old was the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. So I put quotes in from the Mendelssohn all the way through, which tugs at a lot of our heartstrings because it's such an important
piece. He just weaves it in, and it's like, wow, and you're just taken back.
Especially so because Mendelssohn was one of the composers in Nazi Germany that was forbidden.
He was banned, right.
Right. Mm. And then there's a wonderful Jewish wedding dance that builds in the story of Feivel. And then there's a beautiful waltz that happens in a Viennese waltz parody that happens in the story of the story in the concert, Henry's violin, where he was forced to play a concert in the gas chamber by the Nazis because they recognized he was talented and the acoustic was better in the gas chamber. So that's where they wanted to have a concert. So in the same place where his family, friends, and all these other people had been murdered, he was forced to play this concert. And so there's a dialogue between him playing the violin, this happy waltz, because the officer demanded something cheerful, something before all this. And then there's his inner voice. And that's represented by the quartet and the singer of what it is to have to play in this circumstance.
Wow.
So there's an enormous emotional gravitas to all of these, plus the irony and also the musical influences that we have to grab. So it was very challenging but very rewarding piece to write.
Mm. That's the cool thing. He has the aspect from both the violin and the violinist. So the violinist speaks as well as the violin, what it was like to have to play under those circumstances. It's just like, wow, what a concept.
And then there's the quartet of all those instruments, and they're all playing violins of hope. There's one viola and one cello, and those are being played as well. And there, another voice, another internal voice, giving us information about that journey.
Mm. Talking with composer Jake Heggie and violinist Don Harms about Jake's work, Intonations, Songs from the Violins of Hope. Performance this Saturday at the San Mateo, Saturday at the Cole Mansion on a program that also includes Schubert's String Quartet No. 12 and Mendelssohn's String Quartet No. 6 in F minor. As we mentioned, Gene Scheer putting the voice of the violin into words. I'm going to try now to read. You'll be hearing Sasha Cook sing this, of course, but I'll just read the lyrics for Exile, which is the voice of Eric's violin, with the actual violin that Eric owned in the background, played by Don Harms. Eric Mark picks me up nervously, as he did on the cattle car to Dachau, on the march to Buchenwald. He takes me in his hands, touches the string, and I cry like Isaac in Abraham's arms. 1,200 exiles on a ship in the middle of the ocean, on our way to the promised land. But the ship is listing, drifting, and the call goes out, all the coal is gone. We must feed the furnace, find every piece of wood, tear up the floorboards, the railings, the walls, and the doors. Rip the ship apart, every piece of wood into the furnace, now. Is it time to let you go, he asks me. Are you just another piece of wood to fuel the fire? Eric is gone. I am still here. Now every time someone picks me up and draws a bow across these strings, part of me is back in Eric's hands, and I cry again like Isaac in Abraham's arms. Beautiful playing by Don Harms on Eric's violin, part of Violins of Hope, San Francisco Bay Area, public performances, exhibitions, forums, films, and events. You'll hear Sasha Cook sing the premiere of that on Saturday evening at the Cole Mansion. Music at Cole presents this preview concert of Intonation's Songs for the Violins of Hope by Jake Heggie and Gene Shear, with mezzo Sasha Cook, violinist Daniel Hope, as well as Don Harms, and others from the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. Also on the program, Schubert's String Quartet No. 12 in C minor and Mendelssohn's String Quartet No. 6. That's at 2750 Adeline Drive in Burlingame. There's so many events happening in this amazing period that these instruments will be with us. Their West Coast premiere, by the way, violinsofhopesfba.org, a link that we'll have at our website. Dawn, you're involved with several other organizations that will be participating in the Violins of Hope. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yes, it's amazing because we had to pick one instrument, and maybe we'll get to play other ones as the journey, the 3 months go on. But it's amazing. I'm playing, so honored to play Jake's work. And then I'm playing the Vivaldi Triple with the Oakland Symphony. That's on the 22nd of February. Then we're playing, of course, in Grace Cathedral. We'll play Jake's piece. And then I'm conducting, and playing a Chris Brubeck piece called Interlude for Three Violins with Bars, the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, and that's on the 29th of February. And then Kay and I are playing a recital on March 8th on the instruments. That's in, I think it's in, it's a library in Santa Clara. I mean, there's so many.
There's a
Talk
lot.
To my manager because it's, the scheduling is, but it's just an honor to get to just continue playing. And I don't want to seem like it's just a downer. We're also like, that's why we picked the Chris Brubeck piece, because it's such an uplifting, jazzy piece. And these people played, as Jake said, dances, wedding dances, parties. These violins were alive. And so we're playing the Mendelssohn. We're playing Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony because Mendelssohn was banned, of course. So we're going to break out and play that fantastic piece. Then we'll play the Chris Brubeck with Bars on the February 29th. But it's just so cool to get to just play in the different venues and all the different scenarios that these instruments get to speak.
We're also part of a program on at Temple Emmanuel on January 27th, which is the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the 75th anniversary. And Don will be playing Intonations, and the New Century Chamber Orchestra is part of that concert.
I forgot that part. There's New Century Chamber Orchestra, too. I'm playing on that concert, too. And that whole week, we're doing the Beethoven Triple with Lynn Harrell.
And you're in the middle of conducting and preparing the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. How many Dons are there?
Actually, I didn't bring all the others because they're a little sassy.
Is there ever sunset for Dawn?
You know, if I ever had twins, I was going to have a Dawn and a sunset. Why not? Dusk, Dawn and Dusk.
I should also mention that on that commemoration day, January 27th, at the Commonwealth Club, Holocaust Remembrance Day, with the Violins of Hope co-founder Avshalom Weinstein and moderator Rabbi Daniel Stein. Again, all of these events are listed at violinsofhopesfba.org, a link at our website. We should also mention that the Israeli Father and Son Luthiers will be this Saturday at the San Mateo Public Library to talk about James Grimes' book, Violins of Hope, based on these violins of the Holocaust. So many other events going on. Please do check out that link at our website for the Violins of Hope performances.
Can I give one more shout out to Patricia Christoph Moy, who's the head of
Coal Mansion,
music at Coal Mansion, who really made all this happen. She set it in motion, and she's the one who applied. This 3 years ago, she got this going, and she applied to a Hewlett grant to help fund our commission for the new piece. And so we were part of that original group of Hewlett 50, which was lovely. And I'm orchestrating the piece now, and it will be performed by the Cabrillo Festival on August 1st, again with Sasha and with a different violinist, Ben Beilman, and led by Christy Macellaru. But
cool.
it will exist in the chamber version and a fully orchestrated version too.
Incredible.
And that's really, all of this starts with Patricia's imagination. It's just remarkable.
And she's kept all the wheels going when everyone, there's little things,
it's
little hitches.
42 different organizations involved.
It's so
just
calm.
Bay Area presentation.
She's so calm in all of it too.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if she's calm.
Well, her voice is calming. I told her she could be my therapist.
Yes.
Anyway.
There will also be a couple of screenings of documentary about the Violins of Hope, Strings of the Holocaust, with Adrian Brody as narrator, a documentary about the Weinsteins' efforts to restore these violins, one at the Corette Auditorium here in San Francisco Public Library on Friday, February 7th in the afternoon. More information, once again, you can get the link at our website or go directly right now to violinsofhopesfba.org. Jake, tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear from Silence.
Oh, okay.
And what the work is.
This is from a one-act opera called For a Look or a Touch, which was my first piece that I wrote about to deal with the Holocaust. And this was back in 2007, and it was commissioned by Music of Remembrance, led by Minna Miller. And she wanted to commission a piece about the persecution of gays during the Holocaust. And I knew nothing about that. And so I started looking for, writings about it, poetry, something from that era, and there was nothing, because even after the war, according to paragraph 175, it was illegal to be gay in Germany. Just like they had their human rights issues, all like we did in this country up through the 60s and 70s. And so we looked for stories of survivors, which were are documented in a documentary called Paragraph 175. And we took some of those stories as well as other stories that we found and wove a one-act opera between a baritone and an actor and a chamber ensemble into a piece called For a Look or a Touch, because you could be arrested for a look or a touch that was misconstrued.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece was premiered in 2007 up in Seattle with Music of Remembrance, has been performed all over the world, and they are going to reprise it in May, along with Intonations. So the program will be Intonations and For a Look or a Touch, and that will be done in Seattle May 17th, and then at the Conservatory in San Francisco May 19th. This movement called Silence is just the singer humming and a solo cello as Gad Beck, the actor who is reliving this experience, talks about what he went through, but in this case, there's no dialogue. It's just the music.
We're going to be hearing Morgan Smith baritone in this performance. Will he be singing in May as well?
No, it will be Jarrett Ott, and the actor will be this guy that I know pretty well named Kurt Branham.
Yeah, kind of, you know him, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Formerly King Louis of Beach Blanket Babylon. Now Gad Beck in For a Look
or a
Touch.
Oh, he needs work.
He's going to be great.
That's fantastic. Music of Jake Heggie from Silence. Dawn Harms, Jake, thank you so much for coming in today.
Pleasure to be with you.
I wish you a fresh box of tissues to get you all through this.
Thank you.
an excerpt from Silence from For a Look or a Touch, a one-act opera with libretto by Jean Shear, a piece that will be paired with Intonations of Jake Heggie when Seattle's Music of Remembrance performs at the San Francisco Conservatory on May 19th. Violins of Hope, sfba.org, for more information on all of that. Still to come, listener discretion advised for Polly Shamery with actress Kate Robards. And, well, next we're going to talk a little bit about some other exiles, so to speak. Anna Byatt's critically acclaimed one-woman show, Mimi's Suitcase, is an autobiographical journey through identity, immigration, women's rights, and involuntary displacement. With nothing but the titular suitcase, a trench coat, and a scarf, it's a universal coming-of-age story that Anna brings to the stage, and she has some 27 characters, men and women of all ages, performed in four languages, English, Spanish, French, and Persian, Farsi, with English supertitles. Mimi Suitcase returns to the Bay Area for only four performances at the Theater of Eugen at No Space here in San Francisco from January 23rd through the 25th. Anna, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, David. It's lovely to be here.
Another story of that people don't realize. Let's talk about your own childhood and why this was a displacement for you. You were raised in Spain, and then your parents decided to move back to Iran. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think it was so much a decision as much as it was because of the circumstances. We were living in Barcelona, and then the revolution happened in 1979. And then as a consequence of that, things were not as easy as they used to be for us. So, for example, my parents didn't work. And then it was a lot harder to sustain the same lifestyle. And so when the revolution happened, we had to go back because of circumstances and my family business.
And you were growing up in Barcelona. And why was your family in Spain to begin with?
I think it was just purely because my father always loved Spain and flamenco and anything to do with Spain or music, dance, culture. And he had lived in Sitges in Barcelona in the 60s. And we had all moved there even during the Shah's time, even before the revolution. Mm. So our story was the opposite of anybody else's who at the time was fleeing the country because of the revolution and the regime that had taken over the country. In our case, we left during the Shah's time and then we returned after the revolution, which was kind of a going against the current, mm-hmm. in a way.
What I didn't realize is the origin story of the name of the country, Iran.
Iran means land of Aryans. That's what it actually means, linguistically speaking. Now, nobody knows that. Nobody realizes that.
And why was the country name changed from Persia to Iran?
I think the change from Persia to Iran was nothing to do really with the linguistic roots, as I just mentioned. I think it was purely the Shah's father changed it from Persia, which was associated with the Persian Empire, a country that's been there for over 5,000 years. But he said, well, now that I'm taking over, this will, you know, I will be, you know, the Shah of Iran, the land of Aryans.
Wow.
So that's how he...
It's extraordinary that it stayed that way, that it's remained named that way. It really is amazing. Now, let's talk a little bit about what you were told about going back by your parents. Were you ever asked your opinion about going back?
No. No, you know, a 14-year-old girl doesn't have much of a choice. Obviously, you have to be with your parents, whatever happens. And it's funny because my mother and I had really no idea what to expect. And I remember we were at Rome Airport. And we had been told that we needed to maybe have a long coat or maybe, you know, have a scarf or something. Now, we didn't have those things. And I remember we looked like really out of place when we entered the gate because we had two trench coats, you know, in the style of Columbo or a detective story. And then we had tiny scarves in the style of the Queen of England. You know, when it rains, the Queen wears a tiny scarf with a knot under her chin. And so that's what my mother and I were doing. This is, you know, it was a spectacle, the way we entered the country. It was pretty ridiculous.
And as a 14-year-old, that must have been especially difficult with the friendships that you probably formed in Barcelona and going to a land that you really didn't know anything about.
It was really difficult. It was really because if you think about adolescence, if life is already difficult, and on top of that you're entering a country that has undergone a revolution, and all of a sudden there are strict dress rules for women, and then there's a war happening, and then there are slogans of martyrdom everywhere. The Iran that I remembered was an Iran that, you know, the television was filled with American TV shows, dubbed. Dubbing is a very strong skill in Iran. The dubbing is extraordinary, amazing. Even musicals, such as My Fair Lady.
Into Farsi.
Spot on. Beautiful.
Wow.
Yes. And other countries, too, are like that. Turkey and Spain also are very, very good in dubbing. Mm-hmm. But that was the Iran that I remembered. At least on the surface, it was very, very free and very modern. And then all of a sudden, to be confronted with, as you just said, being away from your friends at that age, but also not being prepared, not really having the preparation, whether emotional or otherwise, to know what you're going to be faced with. Mm-hmm. And so that was particularly very, very hard. But something that really helped me snap out eventually was going to drama school. Mm. And so that really helped. I mean, theater essentially saved my life. Theater and pop culture.
I was going to say, with American culture stuck in your head too, that's kind of hard to get out. It's like once you've been to Paris, it's hard to go back to the farm.
That's right.
Did you speak Farsi growing up then?
I spoke Persian at home, yes, and I attended a total immersion French school. And then, of course, with my friends, we spoke in Spanish. My parents spoke German. My father spoke six languages. I grew up very, very multilingually and multiculturally. My family was very European on both sides. It was just a coincidence. You know, it just happened to be that way. And yes, I did. But I didn't know how to read and write very well. So on top of everything, going back and then sort of having to learn the alphabet and all of that, again, you know, it puts you in a position of disadvantage, really.
Help my ignorance here, the difference between Persian and Farsi then.
Farsi is the word you would use in Persian.
Okay.
So it would be like Deutsch is German in German, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But, and so Persian is the English word for the language. But, you know, most people are, I think it's in an effort to sort of say, oh, you know, we know the difference. They start saying Farsi. But if you look at the BBC, it's BBC Persian Services, mm-hmm. never BBC Farsi Services.
Interesting. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So you play some 27 different characters in the course of the show. Describe a few of them for me and how they fit into your narrative.
Well, I think we have, you know, the narrator is there. Then we have an uber narrator who's the, you know, the wise voice. I mean, looking back on the story, you have the revolutionary guards that she encounters, whether they're raiding a party or whether they're on the streets stopping you because maybe you're showing too much hair. So you have the revolutionary guards. You have some older members of the community who are, you know, maybe expressing their views as to, you know, the country's gone to the wind and look what happened here. And basically people really reflecting on what happened to their country and how everything was taken from them.
And for those that aren't fluent in English, Spanish, French, or Farsi, you'll have some subtitles for them.
Yeah, we have super titles in the style of opera. Uh-huh. And so far they've worked really, really well. I've been really surprised that no one has said, oh, gosh, you know, I had to read too much or that's going to dissuade me from, maybe it does. I don't know. But 80% of the show is in English because the narrator will always speak in English.
You've been working on the show since 2007, I think, but it didn't premiere until 15.
Right. Well, no, 2007 was the time when I was attending W. Kamau Bell's workshops in solo performance at Gene Shelton Studios. Mm. And so I would say the early seeds of this, of what today is Mimi's Suitcase, they were planted at Kamau Bell's workshops. But it wasn't until 2015 that I finished the play, and then I took it to New York City, where it premiered at United Solo Festival. And then from there, we went traveling all around Europe and ended at the Fringe, at Edinburgh Festival Fringe, in 2017.
Nice, nice. And so we see the titular suitcase on stage for apparent reasons. What else do we see? We're going to see you in a trench coat for all of the characters, or is there some scene changes involved?
There are quite a few scene changes involved, yes. And of course, we have a very strong multimedia component to the show. There's a lot of music and also projections, all of them authentic, always keeping very, very accurate track on the montage that we have for different historical events and also pop culture and pop music. So because the pop culture of the 80s was a quintessential escape, a channel for youth to escape that type of suffocation when you have to live under a totalitarian regime. It can, you know, we talked about it before, if being young is already difficult and then having to then navigate those uncertain waters, it's even more difficult. And so for us, having posters of, you know, pop icons or music or, you know, Black Market.
Or Down with America.
Well, that's not the people, though.
True,
there's
yeah.
such a big difference between governments and the people. And so the story humanizes people because you know, stereotypes and what the popular media, you know, wants us to believe is not really the story of people. Who are real people? Are real people the ones chanting those things? I don't think so. Not what I've seen.
Interesting. This is, of course, a very timely show, given current events. Has that played into your now interpretation of your own work?
Well, the story starts in 1984 and it ends in 1992. But to your point, it's very difficult to not realize that some of the thoughts and questions that the narrator poses, really speak to what's happening today. When you look around, you realize that a lot of these atrocities are continuing in many parts of the world. And just the beautiful interview that happened right before mine is also another reminder of, you know, we cannot allow certain things in history to repeat themselves because we know that they were not right on a human level, right? And so those things have no nationalities or ethnicities. And so yes, of course, you know, it's a lot of food for thought there.
Yeah. Mm. Anna Byatt's Mimi's Suitcase was the 70th Edinburgh Festival Fringe 2017 pick of the Fringe, and in 2017 was long listed for an Amnesty International Freedom of Expression Award. It's at the Marsh for four performances.
At Eugen Theatre.
My next guest is at the... You can go to the Marsh one night, but do go to the Theatre of Eugen at No Space, 2840 Mariposa Street here in San Francisco. Eventbrite.com for more information. We'll, of course, have links at our website. Anna, I wish you a wonderful run. And we're going to hear a little teaser of your show right now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
باید امشب بروم. باید امشب چمدانی را که به اندازه پیراهن تنهایی من جا دارد بردارم و به سمتی بروم که درختان حماسی پیداست.
It's funny this immigration thing. It's not like you can get on a plane and leave and forget everything you had left behind. And it's not like you can go back and find everything the way you had seen it last. It's funny this immigration thing because wherever you go, there you are. ¿Quién soy yo? ¿Soy las lenguas que domino? ¿O las culturas con las que me identifico? ¿Soy el lugar donde nací? ¿La gente con quien crecí? ¿O lo que he dejado atrás? ¿Quién soy yo?
from Anna Bayat's Mimi's Suitcase at the Theater of No here in San Francisco. Our link is at klw.org through Open Air. A very good afternoon to you. I'm David Latulippe. You are listening to Open Air. Viewer discretion, listener discretion advised for this next segment, I believe. Younger audience members, we might be getting into some interesting topics in this next 10 minutes or so. Writer-performer Kate Robards returns to the Marsh, San Francisco, with her latest hit, Polly Shamaree. Kate has everything she's ever dreamed of, but so does Kate's husband's girlfriend. With a polyamory therapist and sex-positive ethos, Kate begins a polyamorous marriage that goes wrong, a story of his and her and hers and his and sex and therapy and love. Kate Robards joins me in studio. I'm just told a return visit. I forgot the last time you were here, but welcome back, Kate Robards.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. So autobiographical to what degree?
Well, this is my third autobiographical show. And so it's funny because once you've written it, you're then, as an actor and performer, I'm playing a former version of myself. You know, life can only be lived forward but understood backwards. That's my like paraphrasing of a Kierkegaard quote. But it is a character that's me, but I'm an artist who writes about my experiences. So yeah, it is an autobiographical.
Okay. So the title is very carefully chosen. Is it all a sham or a fake, or is it perhaps shamery as well as shamery?
Right. Yeah, there's definitely a double entendre happening in the title. A lot of it is I'm from rural Texas and grew up super conservative Christian. And I went to graduate school in the Bay Area and got married in the Bay Area and was really exploring. I joked that I was studying literature, which I was. And that included, you know, with Proust and Madame Bovary, and which is Flaubert, but In Search of Lost Time, I read Easton and Hardy's The Ethical Slut and began to just explore my own like questioning of my super conservative Christian upbringing. Mm-hmm. And my own like beliefs around sex.
Uh-huh. This is your second show about your marriage after Ain't That Rich?
Yeah, it's kind of a continuation, and I'm working on a book about it, and I wrote a pilot version of this play, which encompasses both of the previous solo show and this show that I would love to have turned into a TV series. But there's just a lot of things that are, you know, I grew up on the poverty line in rural Texas with a single mom, and I married into a fancy Bay Area family briefly, so like a one percenter family, and the access that comes with that. But then also exploring different themes. And that, so my first show was Ain't That Rich, about growing up poor and marrying rich. And this is the continuation show about that marriage ending in divorce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, do you think that, in some ways and shapes that a polyamorous relationship can work?
I do. And I always say, and I know people for whom it does work. And this is just like my own personal foray into non-monogamy. But I always, you know, one of my jokes is that, which is not a joke, it's true. But I grew up with small town youth ministers saying you should save yourself for marriage. And since I've left Texas, I love following them on Facebook and watching them apologize for their affairs publicly. So, I mean, I think like many people I grew up, you know, knowing of so-and-so, how's your mistress? Like, uh-huh. If you want to get out of a ticket, you tell the officer, how's your mistress? But, you know, it's like just really exposing and being honest with it in ways that I think many people can't.
So there's obviously a difference between having an open relationship or a polyamorous relationship and cheating because of the knowledge of between spouses about what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was first like coming out, if you will, to friends in the Bay Area, I told one of my gay guy friends who had recently been married in an effort to find community. I was like, yeah, you know, me and my husband were just like you and your husband, we're open. And he got really, really mad. He was like, Kate, Enrique and I. He was like, Enrique and I are in a traditional marriage. How dare you assume that?
Oh.
He said, we cheat on each other and never mention it.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about some of the jargon surrounding polyamory.
Yeah,
one of my favorite phrases is thrusband.
A thrusband, yes, a thrusband. There's so much.
Define that.
There's so much jargon. I mean, or a thruple. A thrusband is, you know, you have two husbands. A thruple, an OPP, and I really make sure, because part of my
OPP,
own...
OPP? What's an OPP?
A one penis policy, okay. Which is a medical term. It's a medical... A penis is a medical term.
There's also a condom jargon as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, I mean, it's really an exploration of my own learning and discovery about sex-positive attitudes and beliefs, just because, yeah, the sham is also heavily influenced by shame. Like, it was not something you talked about. Mm-hmm. I thought babies were delivered by storks.
Yeah, right. And in your vast experience around the world of polyamory,
I wouldn't say vast.
Okay, well.
I'm not the expert. I am an expert of storytelling.
Okay,
so,
all right. Yeah. Well, in the stories that you know of, are the relationships primarily two men and one woman, or are two women and one man? Or
no, I mean, every scenario has its own distinct, like, partners, paramours, metamours. I mean, and there's so much different jargon. But for me, one of the things that I'm exploring is love in general, and the different forms that they can take within the piece. And it was so interesting to listen to the previous guest's piece where she's playing, you know, 20-something characters, because this show for me is... unlike previous shows where I really played other characters, this show is really rooted in that idea of intimate storytelling. And that's, I think, at our root, what we all long for, our stories.
Nice. Tell us a little bit about the music that is going to be heard in the show.
So it's, you know, it's a very stripped down storytelling show that's like joke heavy. Mm-hmm. And I had a sound design. I have pre-show music and post-show music that all deal with themes of love, but music in the show, I had a great sound designer curate some specific, there's one particular that, you know, I didn't give them to you, but they're very specific sound cues that don't overwhelm, but kind of build to different emotions, if you will.
Well, we have Mary Wells' Two Lovers as a musical example.
Yeah, I love that.
Polly Shamery, a story about her, his, and hers, and theirs, love, written and performed by Kate Robards, directed by Maureen Monterubio. Tell us a little bit about Maureen.
So Maureen is amazing. She is a director, developer, and I really wanted to work with an all-female team. So my sound designer is female, Maureen is female, and she directs audiobooks for Penguin Random House. She just directed child activist Greta Thornburg's book, and she directed Parker Posey, among others. And we're working to get this produced and developed as an audio original. So that's kind of exciting. But she really made sure that we wanted to convey this idea of developing it at a table, so it feels like an intimate conversation and it doesn't feel overly performative, because it is such an intimate subject matter. So in our development process, we've experimented with different props, such as a stage, and ultimately we decided it's just should be the most stripped down version of storytelling. And we have a stool and me, and the costumes were designed by Jasmine Chong, who's going to be on a new Amazon show called Making the Cut. And she made this beautiful, intimate, it's like a robe, but it's also a jacket. And she said it has this idea of deep pockets, coziness, also luxury, and something that you could kind of hide in. And yet it also looks strong and powerful, but it's baggy. So she wanted to have this thing of like this idea of baggage. So, yeah, all female crew working on this with me.
Nice.
Yeah.
New York City-based actor Kate Robards, award-winning writer, comic, and actor, I should mention. Her one-woman show, Polly Shamery, at the Marsh through February 8th. Been the best of fringe festivals around the country, and as well as lauded at the aforementioned Edinburgh Festival. Congratulations, Kate. I'm looking forward to the show.
Hey, thank you so much, David.
Let's hear some music. Mary Wells, Two Lovers.
Two lovers, and I ain't ashamed. Two lovers,
Soundscape from Polly Shamery, written and performed by Kate Robards. It's Mary Wells and Two Lovers. Polly Shamery is at The Marsh here in San Francisco, themarsh.org for more information. Links at our website, kalw.org. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. All of the shows archived at kalw.org. And speaking of one-woman shows, next week I'll be talking with pianist Mona Golubek about her show, The Pianist of Willesden Lane, at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. It's created and directed by our friend Hershey Felder. You'll learn more about that, as well as talk with Obie Award-winning playwright Will Eno about his new play, Wakey Wakey. That and more on next week's Open Air. If you've got a show segment suggestion, by all means, send me an email. I'm David at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.